Good morning. Do you want to greet each one this morning? In Jesus' name, in the very worthy name of Jesus. I was blessed this morning as well in being here and being in the Sunday school and listening to the, and taking part of the discussion, the thoughts that were brought out. And I was especially challenged with the thought of the high priest and how it was made personal to us. How he knew who Jesus was. Like evidence would point to the fact that he would, or point towards it, that he knew who he was dealing with, that he was dealing with the Son of God. And yet he chose to choose himself over that, and how that was made personal to us. I appreciated that. When we study the death of Jesus, the suffering he went through for our sakes, what does it inspire in you? What emotion does it bring in your life? And there's probably different answers. Awe, worship, adoration. I've got some questions this morning to open the message. What is the purpose of our gathering here as a congregation? I wouldn't mind having answers to these, actually. And there's not, you might have an answer that's different than the one I have. But what is the purpose this morning of us gathering here as a congregation? Worship. We've gathered here to do what? Worship. That was the one I had. And maybe a bit on a bit more personal note this morning, what have you come to church to do? Have you come to worship? Isn't that what we're all here for this morning? I hope it is. We have gathered here to worship God collectively and also as individuals. I hope you have. That's what I'm here for. That's what I desire to do this morning, is worship. And then I have one more question. How are you going to accomplish it? How are you going to accomplish it? This morning, that's what I would like to do. I would like to take a closer look at our worship. I want to try to define worship as I believe God wants to be worshiped and how he definitely deserves to be worshiped. Do you ever, one more question, I guess. You don't need to answer this one. Do you ever get just a little bit dissatisfied with our worship? Or maybe your own worship, personal worship? Like you feel like there might be something lacking in it? I confess I do. I have. I don't think I have recently. I feel like I've been more satisfied with my worship recently. Like I feel like, I don't know, how would you describe it? More in tune with God maybe, or like, but I, there are times when I shouldn't say recently, really recently I haven't. I feel like I've really been, like God is so good to me. But there are times, you know, when I feel like there's something missing in it. There's something missing in my worship. There's something missing in our worship here to get this morning as a body, as a group. This morning for a text, I would like to turn to the passage about worship there where John talked to the Samaritan woman about worship in John chapter 4. And we want to read that passage. And sorry, I gotta take care of this little something on the floor here. It's bothering me. It's in the corner of my eye. Sorry about that. This passage here in John chapter 4. But before we turn to it, I want to look at a couple Greek words. And if Greek words burden you, I guess I apologize for that. But I mean, I'm sorry they burden you. Because I'm not a Greek professor. I'm a Greek student this morning, just as you are, or as you are about to become. But as I looked into the Greek words that are used for worship in the New Testament, I was blessed, and I think there's a point to be made with them. And so I want to look at a couple Greek words this morning that are used to describe worship. And I have them here. I'm going to put them, stick them up here somewhere. Actually has another one yet. The first one I have, and this one I was familiar with at least somewhat. I mean, I had known, I had studied this one. I had seen it before. I had probably heard it preached over the pulpit. I'm not sure. But proskuneo, I think is how you say it. I looked them up, and I'm not sure I'm saying them right. But the definition is what I want. Meaning to kiss, like a dog licking his master's hand, to fawn or to crouch. That is, to prostrate, literally or figuratively, oneself in homage. It's translated worship 60 times in the New Testament. Every time it is used in the Bible, it is translated worship. And then the expanded version, or the how the Strong's has after their definition, they sometimes have like two, I think it's Thayer's or other Greek dictionaries. To kiss the hand of one, to fall upon the knees and touch the ground with the forehead as an expression of profound reverence. In the New Testament, by kneeling or prostration, to do homage or make obeisance, whether to express respect or make supplication, used to show homage to men and beings of superior rank, priests, gods, Christ. I abbreviated that just a little bit to get it on that note. But that's about the deepest form of worship, I believe, that we can have. If we think about that, a dog licking his master's hand. When your dog comes to you to lick your hand, what does he want from you? Probably nothing except acceptance, most of the time. Just adoration for you. Not asking anything of you. Most of the time, the word worship is used in the King James Version, and probably most other versions. It comes from this Greek word. It's the Greek word that we will find in our text this morning in John chapter 4 when we get to that, and we'll get to that shortly here. We know what that's about, right? Jesus speaking to the Samaritan woman. He said, you worship, or you prostrate yourselves, you give yourselves wholly to whom you do not know what. We prostrate ourselves in homage, or we worship what we do know, because salvation is of the Jews. That's what he was talking about. It's a very positive definition. It's a definition that shows action. It's the active voice. It's something that we are actively doing and someone is actively receiving our worship. Someone is the beneficiary of our worship. But there is another Greek word I discovered in the New Testament. It's not near as often, but it's also translated worship in the KJV. It's not used near as often. And that word is, well, let's put it up somewhere. I think it's sabamai, is the way you say that. I think it's sabamai. It is the middle voice of an apparently primary verb, to revere, that is to adore. In the KJV, it's translated worship 6 times, devout 3 times, religious 1 time, and they extended the other Thayer's Greek dictionary or whatever it is to revere, to worship. A simpler definition. The middle voice of an apparently primary verb. Do you have any idea what that means? I didn't either. I wasn't even familiar what the middle voice is. We don't have it in the English. But I looked it up, and in the Greek, when a verb is in the middle voice, the one performing the action is referencing himself. Take the verb feed, for example. If feed would be in the middle voice, we would be saying he feeds himself. The doer of the verb is oftentimes also the receiver of the verb. Now, I did find that in worship, it's a little bit different. This verb, sabamai, I think is a little bit different, and it might be more like intensively, or the meaning of it would be used more intensively, like he himself worships. Basically, it reiterates that it's a deep personal, that it's a personal thing. And that's good, right? It's a personal thing. It's between us and God. We are worshiping. It seems to be a good thing. And I think it is. I don't think it's a negative thing. if we look at how that verb is used and where that verb is used in the King James, in the New Testament. But this is also the verb that is used. It is used negatively in some texts or in some places, or I would say kind of negatively. It's the word that is used in Matthew chapter 15 and then also Mark chapter 7, where Jesus says about the scribes and Pharisees, and I think he's quoting Isaiah. He says, "In vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." And that's that verb. "In vain do they themselves worship me, teaching for commandments the doctrines of men." It's themselves that's worship. This verb is also, as you will notice, translated devout and religious about half of the times. I think every time we see this verb in the New Testament, even though it's devout and religious, though it's a good thing, I believe, in a lot of cases, there was something more that was needed. I'd like to turn to Acts chapter 16, verse 14 this morning before we read our text. Acts chapter 16, verse 14. This verb is used to describe Lydia. And I got to say, when I started studying worship here, this message took a little bit of a different direction than I was intending for it to take, or than I ever thought it would take. But Acts chapter 6, verse 16, verse 14. "And a certain woman named Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, which worshipped God," she was a devout woman, "heard us." And then notice what comes after that. "Who, when she heard us, the Lord opened, whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended unto the things that were spoken of by Paul." She was a devout woman. She worshipped God. She had that foundation with God, and God was able to work with that. He opened her heart, and she attended, what does it say? She attended to the things which were spoken of Paul. Lydia was worshiping God. She had a deep personal reverence and a commitment to God, but God wanted something more from her, I believe. "When she heard Paul, the Lord opened her heart, and she attended the things which were spoken by Paul." And if you continue reading, let's continue reading there, actually, in Acts chapter 15, verse 16, let's go to verse 15. "And when she was baptized and her household, she besought us, saying, 'If ye have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and abide there.' And she constrained us." You see what happened? Her worship took on a new meaning. It reached out to others. Her worship included others. Now, again, I don't think that's a bad worship. I don't think it's wrong to be devout. I don't want to leave that impression this morning. But these Greek words in their English definitions look very similar. But the second one has a connotation that is less about actively giving our worship to God, and it's more about our personal reverence to God. It's more about me. It's more about what I have to give to God. It's more about my personal commitment. And so why do I bring these Greek words into the message? It's because, for me, I see that so often, and that's kind of my concern, is that we lose sight of what true worship really is. And in our culture, it can be so easy, and in every culture probably, it can be so easy to make worship about me and God. It's just my commitment to God. It's like my reverence for God. As long as my heart is right towards God, our worship is acceptable to Him. Let's go to our text in John chapter 4, verses 1 through 26. I'm going to start reading at the beginning of the chapter. I wasn't sure where to break in, so we'll read this whole account. "When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but the disciples, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee, and he must needs go through Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, 'Give me to drink.' For his disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said unto her, If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. The woman saith unto him, Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then, hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle? Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. The woman saith unto him, Sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus saith unto her, Go call thy husband and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband, in that thou hast said truly. The woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh, when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman saith unto him, I know that when the Messiah cometh, which is called Christ, when he is come, he will tell us all things. Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. Previous to Jesus coming to earth as the Messiah, the Jews and the Samaritans both followed a strict set of guidelines for their worship. And their guidelines were very similar. They both believed in one God. They both followed the five books of Moses as their law. They both offered sacrifices for their sins. They both kept the Passovers with all its sacrifices. But there was one major difference, and it was where they worshipped. They both believed that where they worshipped was the correct place to worship. But Jesus made this personal. He changed the location of our worship altogether. It's not Jerusalem or Mount Gerizim, whatever it was, but it is in the Spirit. It starts right here in each one of us. Our worship, that deeply personal reverence for God, is our basis for worship. Worship in spirit. And I believe we get that, Sabbath, or however you say that again, that's a basis for worship. It's a reverence for God. That's part of worship. But I guess I think it's kind of an incomplete part, maybe. It's not all of worship. Or I shouldn't say incomplete. It's, if that's all we have, God wants more out of us, or he wants more from our worship. That's the Spirit. That's worship in the Spirit. But you know, there's also truth. We'll worship in spirit and in truth. And I don't think we can separate the two. I don't think we can separate the Spirit and truth. And yet, that is oftentimes my tendency, I feel like. It can be my tendency, where I try to worship in the Spirit, but I leave the truth out. We're satisfied to have a part of worship. We're satisfied to have the Spirit part. We're satisfied with a reverence for God, an adoration for God, for ourselves. We're content to leave it at that. I want to turn back to Leviticus now. Let's not actually turn there because it's quite a bit of reading. I don't know that we may have one thing there to read. But Leviticus, the first seven chapters in Leviticus is what I want to point out there. It's where God gave the instructions for the different types of sacrifices that the Israelites were to offer. For sake of time, I don't think we're going to read them all. I think there's like seven chapters. But the summary of the sacrifices, a small summary, is this, at least for the first couple. The burnt offering sacrifice is the first one that it mentions in chapter 1. And it is a voluntary sacrifice. It was a voluntary offering that Israel offered as an expression of worship to God. And this was before the law, of course, when Abraham offered the sacrifice. But think of how he and Isaac and Jacob, they all, when they worship God, they came to a place of worship, they offered to him. It's a voluntary sacrifice offered as an expression of worship to God. And they brought the best that they had for that sacrifice. The firstling of the flock, without blemish, they offered it to God. It was them voluntarily surrendering their all because of their adoration, because of their reverence for God, I believe. But then the next several offerings, the grain offering and the peace offering, and both the grain offering and the peace offering, it was actually kind of a shared offering. I mean, it was a shared offering. In the grain offering, or the meat offering, it's the meat offering also called the grain offering in some places. In that offering, Aaron and his sons received a share of that sacrifice. And in Leviticus 2, verse 3, God testifies of that offering, and that remnant of the meat offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is a thing most holy of the offerings of the Lord made by fire. As well as the peace offering, I think there was there were some differences to the peace offering, what it was there for, I think, if it was there for Thanksgiving or if it was there for the different reasons they offered. I'm not going to go into all of that. But the peace offering as well, there were times when it was a shared offering. I think the Thanksgiving one was maybe the shared offering one, where the offerer, the one that offered, he ate part of the offering. He was required or asked to eat part of the offering. The God got part of the offering, the first fruits or the certain parts of the offering that God got from that offering, and then the priest got part of that offering. It was a shared offering. And that's the first offering was the first offering that's there in Leviticus is the burnt offering, the voluntary offering of worship, and then the next one is the grain offering, and then it goes to the peace offering. And I think further down in the chapter there are some more regulations to that peace offering. But those are the first three offerings that are mentioned. And I'm not sure that it's really happen chance that it's those in that order. That it's first of all the burnt offering. It's our relation. It's our adoration for God. And then it goes to, and then it reaches out. It goes to, if you're following my thought, and then it goes to others around us, a shared offering. You see the point I'm trying to establish here? Our worship to God is only as good as our relationship with others, as our worship, as how we minister to others. That is part of our worship to God. Micah chapter 8, verses 1 through 8. Hear ye now what the Lord saith. Arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear thy voice. Hear ye, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth. For the Lord hath a controversy with his people, and he will plead with Israel. O my people, what have I done unto thee, and wherein have I wearied thee? Testify against me. For I brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, and redeemed thee out of the house of servants, and I sent before thee Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, consulted, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that ye may know the righteousness of the Lord. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings and with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression and the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. This was under the old law. This was when they were required to sacrifice burnt offerings, when they had the peace offering, the trespass offering, and the fellowship offering, and by the way, the peace offering that I mentioned, that's also called the fellowship offering in some, just for what that's worth. They had the peace offering and the fellowship offering and the burnt offering and the trespass offering I think there are a couple more. They had those offerings. But this is what God's saying to them through the prophet Micah. That's not enough. What are you going to do? How many burnt offerings will you offer? How many rivers of oil will you... Rivers, not bottles. Rivers of oil will you give me? It's not enough. What God really wanted Israel to do here was to do justly And Israel, if you look at the first part of Micah, there was unjust balances. They were cheating their neighbors. They were taking advantage of one another. What God really wanted was for them to do justly, for them to have mercy, and for them to walk humbly with him. Their oblation, their offering, was nothing more than a sham as long as they were working iniquity toward their neighbor, as long as they were cheating their neighbor, taking advantage of one another. And Jesus takes it one step further for us, or I guess it's a step further. In the Sermon on the Mount, it's kind of reiterating that. Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 24. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whatsoever shall kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, that shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way, and be first reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. What is the gift that we are bringing to the altar under the new covenant? Isn't it ourselves, our worship? You know, in the Old Testament, the Israelites brought the best of their flock, the first fruits of their harvest. They gave everything. Of course, we no longer bring a physical offering or as a lamb or the fruits. Jesus gave himself as that offering for us, and he was perfect. I think that first, the best of the flock, the perfect lamb, the first fruits was also represented Jesus. He gave himself as an offering for us in that respect. We claim his blood for our lives. But in return, we give the best we have. We give him our all. We give him our best worship. And part of that worship, I think we find here in Matthew chapter 5, before that worship can mean anything, we seek restitution. Part of that worship is seeking, doing our best to have a relationship, a clean relationship, for lack of better description, with our brothers, a good relationship. I think that's why we teach restitution as being part of the conversion experience. And there are several things in this passage that I want to point out. The first thing that I see is that when we remember, if we are on our way to the altar and we remember, and if you're here this morning and you're wondering if there's something that you need to make right but you're not sure what it is, if you don't, it's when we remember. And this is actually something that I think we can struggle with. I struggled with this some as a young Christian. I was quite rebellious before I was born again. But I did live a somewhat upright life. I was against my moral code, if you call it that. Like stealing and some of that stuff. I didn't have a lot of that. Like most of the things I had to make right with were with my parents after I was born again. And I struggle with that a little bit. Like, how do I know that, especially when I came across this teaching of restitution, I was like, how do I know that, did I make everything right? But I think we do not need to live in fear that we have something or something against us, that there's something to make right if we don't know of anything. We can't, if Jesus or if God wants us to make something right, he will show it to us. It's when we remember, when you're on your way to the altar, is when we make that right. And the other thing that I see here is, if thy brother have aught against thee, not the other way around. It's if I know that my brother has something against me. It's if I am in error. This passage here is if I am in error, I am responsible to make that right. If I am the offense. And as far as how we make that right, we can probably look at it a little differently depending on what the error is, but It says, go to thy brother and be reconciled. It may mean apologizing for an unkind word. It may mean replacing something that we broke or lost or stole. It may mean humbling ourselves to the opinions. It may mean humbling ourselves and our opinions to our brothers for their input in our life. And I think sometimes that's the hardest one. If I know that if I'm stuck up and I know I'm a sticking point in someone's life, just apologizing for that. That one can sometimes be the hardest one for me. In this passage, I don't think it necessarily means we are fixing our brother. It's us seeking restitution for our error. The fixing our brother thing, that's probably another message. This is us making our wrongs right. And why beholdest thou the mote in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast the mote out of thy brother's eye. And that's in Matthew chapter 7, 3 through 5. It's just a couple verses, a couple of chapters on down here in Matthew. Oftentimes conflict can be resolved if we humble ourselves. And if we go to whoever the conflict is with, and we apologize and say, I am in the wrong, I am sorry. You might be surprised how often that step alone will resolve that conflict. And I encourage you, if you know somebody that has a problem with you, or if you know somebody, if you know you have an error to make right with it, with someone, don't delay. If there's friction between you and someone else, don't delay. Make it right. Whether it's between you and your wife or your brother and sister, make it right. Because from what I see in this passage is we're not in a position to worship as long as we keep harboring that, as long as we can't humble ourselves to make that error right. That relationship with our brothers is so important before we can present true worship. And then we can bring our gift to the altar, and then we can present our worship to God, and we can worship Him in spirit and in truth. Again, I remind us of Israel bringing those offerings without blemish, giving the best they had out of a worship and an adoration, a reverence for God. At least that was God's intention, and I think it was what He truly deserved. But, you know, throughout Israel's history, their worship devolved into just a meaningless practice where they just offered their sacrifices. It happened time and time again. It happened here in Micah, where it was just they were going through their sacrifices and it had no impact on their life. And I believe the same is true for the church. It can be so easy for the church to fall into the same habit, the same rituals. It's so easy to just come to church and we have our rituals, we sing our song, and then we sing three songs, and then we have our devotions, and then we have our Sunday school, and then we sing another song, and then we have the message, and then we have the opening, and then we have the message, and then we're done, and then we go home, and then we eat. But who are we worshiping? We're here to worship God, aren't we? We're here to worship the Lord. And He deserves our worship. He wants our worship. Maybe the reason our corporate worship tends to become so ritualistic is because that's the worship that we have in our hearts. Did you ever think about that? Isn't the worship that we have here as a body, as a group, isn't it a result of the worship that all of us have in our hearts? Isn't it a result of the adoration or the lack of adoration that we have in our hearts? Isn't it a result of how we feel towards God and how we see and appreciate or don't appreciate what Jesus has done for us? Isn't it a result of all of our love, all of our adoration for God? You know, as we look at the church through history, her worship styles seemingly just continues to evolve with the world. And some say that we need to keep evolving so that we keep attracting more people, so we keep our members. I'm not so sure. I guess I don't really agree with that. If we need to change, I don't know, the style of our music to keep our members, I would say that worship is geared more towards us than it is towards God. And we look at churches around us, and it's so easy to find fault with their worship. Churches bring in contemporary bands to lead their worship services. Pastors become careful not to offend anyone because we want to bring everybody into the church. We can look at those. We can look out there and find fault. But what about us? Why is it so important that our worship services end by 11:15? Or why is it so easy to be critical over the songs we're singing or the way the songs are sung? Oh, it was sung so slowly this morning. Would it have helped you worship better if it would have been sung rapidly? Yeah, probably would have actually. I mean, maybe. You know me, I kind of like my fast songs. But there's a balance. But who are we worshiping? And why is it so important that the preacher delivers his message in an interesting way? And here's one. Why is it so important? I don't know if I should say this. Why is it so important that we have a nice new facility up on the hill? We will really be able to worship up there, won't we? We will have all the room in the world. We will not have people jamming in the entrance. We will have all the room for fellowship lunch. I'm not against that building at all. But I guess the point I'm trying to leave is can our worship become about us and not about God? I think it can sometimes. And that's my concern this morning, that our worship is about God and it stays about God, and that we are here to worship God and not about us. And the methods and the practices for our church are not wrong. I appreciate the fact that I come to church and I know what's going to happen. I appreciate the fact that I come to church and we have three songs in the morning. I appreciate the fact that after the songs we have a Sunday school devotional. But you know what I've found? Oftentimes, going back to those songs, oftentimes, and I'm not finding fault with the song leader at all. That was just an example I had. It's something that we have, I mean, I've done in the past. I have found that how much those songs mean to me and how much I worship in those songs is how much it relates directly to my relationship with God. It doesn't matter if it's a slow song or a fast song. Actually, a lot of slower songs give you more time to maybe contemplate on the words. And again, there's a balance. I wouldn't want to sing so slow we couldn't keep up. But how we worship, how it affects us, is more a result of my relationship with God than it is about how the song was started or how fast we're singing, how slow we're singing. And the preaching, how much the message means to us, how much the message changes me, has more to do with my relationship with God and my relationship with my fellow man than it has to do with how the preacher delivers it. I believe for us to worship, truly worship in spirit and in truth, it means humbling ourselves to the control of His Spirit. And that takes humility at times. Allowing the Spirit to work in my life. Allowing the Spirit to say through me what He wants to say through me. Allowing the Spirit to touch me to the needs of my brothers and sisters the way He wants to touch me to the needs of my brothers and sisters. Because that too is worship. It means yielding myself completely to the Spirit. Thinking again of that all, that perfect lamb. It was the best they had to give. The best I have to give is my everything. And it's the only thing that is good enough or it's not even good enough, but it's the only thing I have to give, and so I give everything. That is worship. That's the worship I believe that God wants from us, from all of us. Romans chapter 11, verses 33 through 12, verse 2. And here's the final. There is one more word for worship here. I want to have this one in closing. Romans chapter 11, verses 33 through 12, verse 2. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor? Who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again? For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom are glory forever. Amen. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable worship, which is your reasonable service. This passage, let me keep reading one more verse. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. This passage, this word service, is translated from the Greek word latrio, I think. Let me put this one up here as well. One more word. I'm about out of space. Maybe I'll just put it on top of this one. To minister to God, especially. That is, to render religious homage. And it is translated in the King James Version, serve 16 times, worship 3 times, do the service 1 time, and worship for 1 time. And the Thayer's or whatever dictionary they get this expanded version or expanded definition is from is to serve or minister of slaves and free will alike, to worship, or perform sacred services, to offer gifts, to worship God in observance of the sacred rites used for worship. In simpler terms, I think we can maybe define this word for worship as the outworking. It's still an action verb, but it's the outworking. It's the outworking of our worship. It's because of our adoration, because of our, because of the adoration and the reverence and the love we have, we come to this one. Where we minister, where we give everything we have, the outworking. It's what we can give. It's what we can do. When we realize the depth of God's wisdom out of this passage, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. When we realize His wisdom, His love for us, when we understand His heart for us, when we catch a glimpse of His plan for us, we can do nothing but worship. And that worship, that true worship, that coming to Him with that fawning, licking like a dog licking his master's hand, that true worship will result, I believe, in an outworking. It will result in a physical outworking. It will result in relationships. It will result in us seeking to maintain those relationships, seeking to have those relationships right and good and open. When we give all of ourselves to God, He will change us. And this change, I believe, is important to our worship. And then when we let the Spirit take control of our worship, when we let Him take control of our lives, it will make a difference in the outworking of our worship. Shall we come before the Lord in prayer?